Sophie, how do you feel when something in your life goes wrong or falls apart?
I feel sad and depressed. I feel awful.
Okay, well, maybe you should just be grateful, okay?
Okay.
Abby Wamba, I'm a comedian, I'm a parent, I'm a writer, I'm a lover, I'm not a Buddhist, but I see the appeal.
I'm Sophie Hagen, stand-up comedian and author, and I am not a Buddhist, but I bear some resemblance to the laughing Buddha statue. So minus the earlobes, the hanging earlobes.
I will say that Sophie does have earlobes. So if you put some laughing Buddha statue pictures in our document, and I really like them.
I just need you to know it's not just something I'm saying. Like, there is a resemblance. That genuinely, I mean, he has these like very big, and I'm not earlobe size shaming earlobes. That's the only thing we don't have in common. He also often has quite long toes.
I feel
other than that, it's a match.
I feel like you could go this direction with a headshot at some point.
I would love that. It's a very cute statue. I wish I had one.
Okay, listen up, everybody. Sophie wants a laughing Buddha statue.
I don't know if that's insensitive. I would treat it with respect.
I don't think it has to be insensitive. And you're listening to Help Hole, our podcast that we love so much.
We love it so much. Every month you get two episodes, one where I read a self-help book and tell Abby the best things I got out of it.
And one where I read a self-help book and I tell Sophie all the things I got out of it. We're also telling you and we're talking about it. We're just chatting about them.
And if you're thinking two a month, that is not enough, then you should join our Patreon.
Yes. Then you get a whole bonus episode every other week where instead of books, we discuss a movie, a person, an app, a podcast, or answer your questions. And it's still all with the goal of trying to make ourselves better.
Yes. In case you weren't paying attention, that means that for our Patreons, we are a weekly podcast. And by signing up, not only do you get bonus episodes, you also get to help keep this podcast ad-free. I hate adverts and podcasts. Like, it's just really grinds my nerves. So if you're on the same page as me with that, you're gonna want to join Patreon. You also get discounted tickets for shows, and you get to vote on which books we cover next.
By the way, this is the first full episode we're recording where we have two Patreon producers of this podcast. So thank you so much to Lily, and finally my mom, who is now a Patreon, is a producer Patreon, a tryhard, and who also pronounces, I can't even say it the right way anymore, Patreon. My mom pronounces it Patreon, which
yeah, so
is
now we do too.
The best. So we will always be saying that from now on too. And my mom also wanted me to point out that even before she became a Patreon producer of this podcast, she was a producer of this podcast because she produced me. Okay, Mom. Now I said that. Thanks, Mom. Thanks, Lily.
Is your mother going to be coercing you into saying a bunch of other things?
Maybe.
On this podcast?
I probably do a lot of things my mom would ask me to do. I'd probably do a lot of them.
If I had a child who had a podcast, I would be doing that all the time.
Yeah. My mom did point out that your mother also is a producer of the podcast. She really wanted you, like, she's like, me and Sophie's mother are the original producers of this podcast.
My mother once coerced me into saying, when I started doing stand-up, she was like, do you know what I don't like about stand-up? They always talk badly about their wives and their mothers. So I want you to go and tell them that they have nothing bad to say about their wives and their mothers because they are all nice people and they shouldn't be saying stuff like that on stage. And I was like, haha, yeah, that's funny. And she was like, no, go and tell them. And she wouldn't let it go until I'd gone into like the dressing room of the comedy club and been like, guys, my mom would like for you to know that you shouldn't be saying things about your mothers and your wives on stage. And they were like, okay. And I was like, yeah, no, she really means it. I'm serious. You have to stop.
Oh my God, that's really sweet.
It is very sweet.
Some parts of my stand-up are just repeating verbatim things my mother said.
And I've done that too.
She gets really worried whenever I'm around her and I take out my notebook. She goes, what did I say? What did I say now?
Oh, before we start, let's just do a little disclaimer. Just a note to say, we can't do this podcast without these books that people have spent years researching and writing. And there is usually always value in reading an entire book rather than just a summary of what we thought was useful. So go support the authors and buy the books. This is not a review podcast. We love books like these and we just like talking about them. And even if you don't like what we have to say about the books, buy them anyway, since we might be wrong. Help
hole. Today I'm presenting When Things Fall Apart by Pema Chodron. Sophie, do you have any relationship to this book? Have you read it? What do you think about it from the title?
With most of the books that you bring to the podcast, I have never heard of it before. Doesn't speak to me particularly. It sounds, just based on the title, it sounds like it's going to be like dark.
Mm.
Like when things fall apart, like it sounds like a sad movie, doesn't it?
Mm. Yeah, it kind of does.
Is it a sad book? Are we going to be sad today?
No, I think it's not a sad book, but it talks about what happens when sad things happen. I had this book laying on my coffee table or next to my bed. I've had it like laying out in public in my house for like the last 9 years. And I do think when people see you have a book out called When Things Fall Apart, they are like a little worried about you.
It feels like if I was a bookseller and someone bought that book, I'd be like, okay, do you need to talk to someone? Are you... Is everything okay at home?
Yeah, but mostly everything is okay. But also in the way that everything's okay and everything's not okay. And this book is really nice. This is the first time I've gotten all the way through the book. I've started this book a lot of times. My partner has read this book a bunch of times. And I'm always like pretty glad when I see him. I'm like, oh, he's getting somewhere. I'm like, oh, maybe I'll get somewhere in this book sometimes. But I thought I would tell you a story about why I picked this book and why it came into my life. Do you want to hear it?
I would love to hear it.
Good, because this whole podcast is about us wanting to hear from each other, so.
Yeah, it would be weird if I was like, nah. Nah. No, thank you. I want nothing to do with you.
Well, in my mid-20s, I got accidentally pregnant and decided to have a baby. And that really kind of threw me off. I knew I wanted to be a parent one day. I definitely didn't want to do it then. Some people are ready to have a baby when they're 25. I was not ready. I was like, not ready. And so when my partner and I decided this is what we were going to do, it was really hard. The whole pregnancy for like when she was little, we felt like it was really like us growing up and having to like learn a lot of things about ourselves. Have you ever had a situation where you felt like forced into growth that you didn't feel ready for?
Not to that extent, I think. I don't think I've experienced anything that I could possibly say that would match having a baby. Like, what am I going to say? Like, oh yeah, one time I lost my bus pass and then like I had to walk. Like, come on.
Yeah, good. That was just a question I was asking to make you look stupid. So there are lots of things like that happen to people, though. Good things, bad things, things that like toss them into the unknown. It isn't the only biggest thing, having a baby. But for me, it was. It was like an only biggest thing. We really spent like the first 2 years of being parents, like really trying to figure our shit out and get shit together. We were in New York. We were living in an apartment with 5 roommates. I was a teacher. I was like sometimes wearing my baby to school and like just teaching with her there. Yon took a job that he could do with the baby too. We couldn't pay anybody for childcare. We were really like trying hard to figure it out and it didn't feel like we had a break. In the world though, we had this big break, which was that Yon is Danish. So although we didn't have any resources in New York and as young parents in the way that we felt like we needed them, we could move to another country and restart our lives where the government was supposed to help us with that stuff. So we tried to do that when our kid was like 9 months old. And we lived there for like 6 months trying to get it all together, trying to set it up so that we could stay in Denmark. And we screwed that up. Like we submitted the papers days afterwards. It was just like another confirmation that we were not ready for this. We couldn't get it together. We had to come back to America and like start over and like figure it all out again. So our kid is like one. We have a little baby. We have to move into the basement of my parents' house.
Wait, so you moved when the... so when the child was 9 months old, you moved to Denmark and then you had to go back after a couple of months?
Yeah. So we moved and we were like, we're going to move to Denmark. We're going to set up a life in Denmark. This is what makes sense for our family.
We got so stressful.
Denied for residency. Some of that was because there's a lot of stuff you need to do for that is xenophobic and messed up. Yeah. And some of it truly was we couldn't figure out to get the papers on time and we didn't know what the papers were.
Yeah, because they don't make it easy to emigrate to Denmark.
Yeah. So then
so now you're back in New York.
So now we're back in America. We can't move back to New York. We don't have a place to live anymore. We got rid of our room. We don't have a place. It's really expensive to move to New York. We moved to Pennsylvania. We live in my mom and my stepdad's basement. That's an unfinished basement. They were really sweet. They like put a bed down there. They tried a rug. They tried to make it nice, but it was a basement with like concrete and mold. We had a baby down there and we were just like, what? Our life is a shambles. And we were just really trying to figure out all this out. My partner was working on my dad's landscape crew. And I was like, what am I going to do? I applied for a job to work again at the school that I had left when we were going to move to Denmark. I quit my job as a teacher at this like progressive school in Brooklyn. And they had a job opening that was for a different thing for much younger kids than I was used to working with, but I was just like grasping and that was like my community. And so I applied for it and I got the job. So we're in Pennsylvania. We need to move back to New York, but we don't have any money. We don't have any apartment. We're trying to figure this out. And through a friend, someone says, you can stay with us for a month. This is a guy that we've met a few times. We really like him, but we're not close to him. His name is Pete, and he is a friend of a friend who's like a mentor to me, the person who introduces us to him. He says, stay with me for a month while you figure this out. You can come, you can look at apartments, you can find something that works for you. And we're just like, we really have loved every interaction with this guy, and we've had a nice relationship with him, but we're not that level of friends. We're not like stay with you for a month house guest friends, but we have no other option. And so we just, if that's real, if we can really do that, then yes, please. So we go and we move into his apartment with him. He moves out. It's a 2-bedroom apartment in New York City. It's a very nice apartment, but it's not new. And he's a carpenter, which means that all around the apartment, there are saws, there are hammers, there are nails, there are workbenches. And we're moving in now with like a 1-year-old, 1.5-year-old toddler.
Is he Jesus?
Oh, yeah. Well, okay, no.
Is that what this is? Because at one point I was like, oh, it's going to be like a serial killer story because I've listened to too much true crime.
No, it's just...
And now you're saying carpenter.
Yeah.
Is this going to turn out to be Jesus?
No, he's just the nicest guy. He's just the nicest guy. Like,
do you know who else was a very nice guy? I think you know Jesus.
I'm trying not to be like too self-conscious. I think he's probably going to listen to this because he's such a nice guy and he still like supports me and stuff.
Oh, Jesus.
And hi, Pete or Jesus. Oh, he's going to hate that. But I'm trying to really tell you guys the truth and not embarrass him too much. But he like it was an insane thing that he did. And he just like gave us the bigger room. He moved into the little room. He was so generous. He made all of his like carpenter stuff safe. Just such generosity, made us feel so welcome at a time where we really felt like we didn't deserve anything. And then we're there. I'm starting work. We're looking for apartments. We've like go and see a few places, but we don't know how we're going to make it work. I'm making money at this point, not a lot of money. We just like couldn't really afford anything. Everything was like smaller, and it was moving from this nice situation where we had with Pete, where we were spending time with someone, to go off and be alone by ourselves in like a studio apartment, because that's what you're supposed to do. Like you're supposed to have a family unit alone as a family unit. And it just felt so sad. So at the end of the month, Pete was just like, you know, you guys should just take your time. Take your time and stay here. And this isn't going to last forever. And this has been so nice. Why don't we just keep going? And we wanted that so bad, but it was really hard for us to accept that he meant it and that we weren't just in his way or like intruding in his life, for us to accept when he was saying that we were actually adding value to his life to have like a young family around. He's like my parents' age, so he's like a different generation, and it just felt like It was really hard for us to accept that, but we did. And we just kept kind of deciding to keep going for 3.5 years.
Wow.
Yeah. During this time, we got a safe, wonderful place to live, but we got to have this relationship with someone that's not in our family that we still have. Obviously, we didn't like stop talking to him when we moved out.
Like, bye bye.
Thanks so much. Thanks for your time. But like the relationship that he built with my daughter, he just had patience for her that I didn't even understand. Like he would build towers of boxes with her for an hour and just be like delighted when she was delighted. This kid is not a, she's a, what they call a tough nut to crack. And this guy just like put in the time, built this beautiful relationship with her, and he would give us advice. He was never condescending to us, but he had a different perspective that was so valuable to us. He's not Jesus, but he but he was practicing something that I didn't have a lot of familiarity with, where I was like, how are you this nice and wise and patient? And he turns out he's a Buddhist. He's a Buddhist. He wouldn't say he's a Buddhist. He would say he's a bad Buddhist. Oh, no, he couldn't say he's a Buddhist because he doesn't do it right. He would say those things. But he, like, practices meditation. He tries to go to Buddhist talks and meditation. And I don't think I really realized how much of a Buddhist he is until I read this book all the way through. And I realized how much, how much of what I think of as Pete, he shows of Buddhism, which was really special.
I know almost nothing about Buddhism.
Me too.
Which is why I referenced him as Jesus. Yeah. And now I realize he is potentially Buddha.
Yeah. Well, I think he's just a good person trying. I think that's what he is. I don't think he's Jesus or Buddha. I think he just goes into every day and as much as possible, every interaction, thinking like, that is what is happening. It's so much easier for me to understand the idea of being present when I think of what I got from being around someone who is really practicing that than it is for me to think of what I would get from being present.
Yeah, I think I understand that.
I reaped the rewards of this lifestyle. And when I think about it that way, which I truly only started to like shift in my mind this week preparing for this. And when I think about it, the things that I got from somebody else being that way, it is so much easier for me to imagine how that would contribute if more people were trying that all the time.
Yes. And it also feels like by doing something incredibly kind, you are starting like a chain of, well, hopefully in an ideal world, you start a chain of events, right? Where you do something nice for someone that makes them want to do something nice for other people. And hopefully that just seeps into society.
What a guy.
Had he read When Things Fall Apart, or did the book just remind you of him?
The book really reminds me of him, but it was his book. He read this book. He read all like the Pema Chodron books, and he would just like talk to us. He was never preachy at all. Like that's, I think, important for me to say. He was never like, you know what would really help you, Abby? It's some Buddhism. Now, in reflection, and even then in moments, I could see that him having us around, and especially my daughter, brought him joy, and that that was good for him, and that the alternative was that we weren't there, and that was like less joy and less connection. But I just felt this was like a mess that I had made with my life. You know, if I had been on top of things, if I had been prepared, done things better, nobody would have to fix it for me. And the fact that he was helping me with such open-heartedness, it touched me so deeply. And also, like, I felt a little shame because I've been taught that I should be able to do everything for myself, and that if you have a kid, you should be able to like afford a house. And I couldn't. And there are many people who can't. And that doesn't make them bad. But it was really hard for me to believe that about myself. And also like just the idea of connection through generation. I have Pete and I have two other friends who are in their 60s, like around my parents' age, who are just wise and kind and funny and so grown up that I always like couldn't believe they wanted to be friends with me, that they were just doing me a favor or that they were like mentoring me. The first friendship like that started because I was her kid's teacher and she was the guidance counselor at the school that I worked at. So that felt reciprocal in a way that I could like believe.
I can so imagine being 50, 60 years old and then having a spare room, liking the idea of someone else's family moving in and
yeah.
being there for them, but not having the, you know, I don't have to be, like, I don't want kids, but I would love to have kids in my life that I can, like, hang out with whenever
yeah.
and babysit and stuff, as long as I don't have to be the parent of them.
Yeah.
So I can easily imagine that being super joyful and me being like, this is so great for me. I would understand that it would be read as selfless, but it wouldn't feel selfless, I think.
But can you?
It would just feel like, yeah, well, it's a two-way street.
Which is so beautiful. Like, I think that is such a beautiful thing that that is real in the world and that I truly know that it's real because I have experienced it. What I think is crazy isn't that part, actually. It's like accepting that from someone. Can you imagine?
Oh, yeah. No, no. The other way around. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. No, someone wanting to give me anything at all? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Totally. If you can imagine being the person giving it and enjoying that, you should also be able to imagine that that is true for the person giving you something,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. Actually, this is not what the book is about, but I think that this is such like a valuable conversation that like we would have. When you think about it, truly grateful acceptance of generosity is just as important as generosity to make those moments happen.
Yes.
That couldn't exist. I think I'm like a little bit giving myself a pep talk because it's true. It was so hard for me to accept. But now like looking back, like I'm so glad that I did. I'm so glad that I didn't just like move into a tiny studio with my family because that was the right thing to do. That felt like the correct action based on what society had told me about what I should be able to provide, how I should keep to myself. Thank God I didn't. I got this most incredible, special experience that made my life better and probably Pete's too.
It also made Pete's life better.
Yeah.
You do know, I know you yeah. struggle to say it,
yeah.
but all of us listening, we know for a fact that this made Pete's life better.
Oh.
And what I'm thinking, like you, in one of our bonus episodes, I think the one where we talked about the movie Leave the World Behind, you were talking about how if there was like a zombie apocalypse, you would go and adopt all the kids
yeah.
from your street and like take care of them. So like you're definitely also this that kind of person yourself.
Oh, I know that I am. I know that I am. But I also think I am because of Pete. That was in me. It existed. I wanted to help. Because I had these grown-up friends, that's like the way that Yon and I thought of them, is like they were grown-ups and we were children. And how nice of them to teach us how to be grown-ups. Because I had these people like showing me how to do this, I had like a direction to point these feelings that I, you know, I wanted to grow. And there were things that I admired about these people in my life that I could figure out how to picture where it could go. One of the biggest gifts in my life was to have these unrelated to me people of a different generation decide that I was worth their love and time and resources. And I would love to give that to other people. And I do try to. And I think that's fucking, it's a good vote for Buddhism. It's a good vote for Buddhism.
And now I know where I'm going to be staying when I'm in Denmark.
You are very welcome. Help
all. My only version of that story is when I was seeing my first therapist when I was incredibly depressed and like self-harming and all sorts of stuff. And she was so helpful and so good. And the deal we'd had was that my dad would my dad was never present and I no longer speak to him, but he would sometimes pop up and my mom couldn't afford to send me to a therapist. So we were like, we have to call your dad. I was like, oh God. So we called him up. He came over and he was basically saying, yeah, but it's really expensive. And I, a very dramatic teenager, I went into my room and I looked up how much a funeral cost. And I like printed it all out and I went back into the room and I was like, so you can either pay like £100 every other week for this therapist. Or you can pay, I think it was like, £3,000, £6,000, however much a funeral costs
wow.
now. So it's either or. which is, I mean, looking back at teenage me, mwah, beautiful work, beautiful,
really
work.
Incredible, like, advocating, okay. Just like how the presence of mind it must have taken to put together that argument. Poof.
Oh, so anyways, he was like, "Yeah, I'll pay it." Okay, so we didn't. So like, she, my therapist would send the invoices to him. She never mentioned it to me. I never mentioned it to her. He never mentioned it to me again. It was fine. Then it must have been 4, maybe 5 years later, me and my therapist were having a chat about charity because I'd started working for UNICEF and I was trying to poach her and be like, do you want to support UNICEF for £6 a month? And I just sound like a very annoying teenager, don't I? I was. And she was like...
No, I love teenagers. I think you sound great.
She was like, well, I'm already, doing charity on my own. I was like, oh, that's so cool. What do you do? She said, well, I see clients for free sometimes if, like, they don't have the money or anything like that. And I was like, oh, my God, that's amazing. I was like, I can't even imagine, like, how big of a difference that makes in someone's life. And she was like, well, I like you. And I was like, sorry, what? She was like, I like you. So it's, like, nice for me. I barely do any work with you because you're really easy to talk to. And I was like, what do you mean me? And she was like, oh, well, your dad stopped paying after 6 months.
Oh my God.
Did you not know that? And I was like, I absolutely did not know that. And she was like, oh, yeah, well, yeah, he stopped paying, so I've just continued to see you. I could not believe that. Because if she had done the thing that she would have been so entitled to do, of stopping it after I stopped paying her, I don't know if I would have survived. We couldn't have afforded a therapist anyways. So it's like having someone literally save your life and never bring it up and like never mention it, never... Like, when I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it. She was just like, oh, no, it's fine. Like, she was so calm about it and so okay with it. That is the closest thing I've come to something like generosity of that sort. She really did not have to do that. And I talked a lot imagine having me as a, like, if you're a therapist, imagine having me as a client. I'm not an easy client, despite what she said. It's very much me being like, okay, so here's what I need us to do now. And her being like, oh, Jesus Christ, okay.
Wow. But
that was mind-blowing. Like, she literally saved my life.
That's so amazing.
That's my Pete.
Did she get a name?
I mean, Panilla?
Panilla? I just keep thinking Pete's going to hate this. Panilla? Panilla and Pete? All really generous people have P names.
Start with P-E?
Yeah. Oh, P-E.
Well.
Wow.
Pima Chodron? Who wrote the book?
Boom! Great segue.
Great segue.
Okay.
PE people are really better people. That's fascinating.
All right. Did you ever have something really bad happen to you or something really fall apart in your life? And then it was... Have you ever had anything bad happen to you, Sophie?
No.
But then
not a single thing.
It turned out to be a good thing or it changed the way that you thought in a good way.
Yeah, I mean, I very much believe that. It feels like a very privileged thing to say, but for myself, when bad things happen, they always seem to be for a reason. Even if it's really hard and shitty, it'll always turn out to be something that I needed somehow. And I went through a really shitty breakup in 2015. But it really felt like the earth disappeared underneath me. It was such a shocking moment for me. But I think having to rebuild after that, because I kept saying I am broken. Like, I feel like I've just been broken, like broken down into nothing. And then, but coming out of that was so incredible. I was crying so hard and more than I've ever cried before and since. And then I remember just waking up and feeling like a new person. Like, it sounds so weird, but I was, like, walking down the street and I could, like, hear the birds and, like, smell the flowers. And I was like, oh, shit, like, something has shifted. Like, I've been pulled out of some kind of attachment or something that wasn't good for me. And, like, I've been living in this other world where things weren't great, but I also wasn't present. And then suddenly I was out and he was gone. And I was like, oh, this is what the world looks like when I'm not living in my head in this, like... obsession with this other person. I mean, I still think of that time after the breakup as one of the best times of my life because I was so present because I'd been forced to become present because reality had like knocked the door and been like, hi, you're not going to want to meet me, but here I am.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a lot what this book is about. It's about how in those moments, that thing you feel when like the thing you were counting on and putting all your stuff in before falls away, that's actually the time where you can see reality the clearest. Mm. You can hear the birds and you can smell the flowers because that's what's real. And your mind isn't on, your mind is struggling to find what's out there now that the thing you were believing is gone. It's pretty cool. I think I've definitely felt that too. I think it's really interesting, Pema Chodron, she started down the Buddhist path when something similar happened to her, actually. She was in a marriage. She had two kids. She was married, I think, to her second husband, though. And after 8 years of marriage, I mean, not though, like her second husband, though, so it didn't really count. Anyway, she was married. Her husband came home one day when she was really not expecting it. And she just like came out to say hi to him in the driveway. And he like stood by the car and said, I'm having an affair. I'm leaving you. She describes that moment as she could feel the tea in her hands, like the steam coming off of it. She could hear everything around her. Everything slipped away. And then she like threw a rock at her husband. And then, but that started her down the path of Buddhism because she was like, what was that? What happened there? How do I have more of it? And she talks about that moment as like saving her life, that she hated her husband for that. She was driven by anger to figure out what the next thing was. Like she should thank him because that's what made her see what else there is out there.
Wow.
Yeah.
God, if I'd read that when that was how that breakup happened, it was so extremely out of the blue. There were no red flags. It was just suddenly his face changed and he was like, last Monday I fell in love with someone else.
Oh my God.
It was so out of the blue. Like a week before, we've been talking about living together and starting a family and yeah, things fell apart. It feels exactly like, I didn't throw a rug at him though. I did cry and refused to leave his flat for 24 hours, so I did hold him hostage for a while, but no violence.
So after that happened to her, she read an article about Buddhism, and it just like really resonated about that moment, about the thing that happens when things fall apart. And she didn't know it was Buddhist, then she found out it was Buddhist, and she sort of like just started walking down that path. She obviously got pretty far down that path. She was the first American Tibetan Buddhist nun, and she's 86 now. She still speaks a lot, and she's pretty cool. This book, though, is a lot about Buddhism. Obviously, she's Buddhist. It's about Buddhist wisdom and how it can help you in your life. I don't know a lot about Buddhism. I don't know a lot about it. I had to keep looking up words in this book. It was kind of one of those books where she would like say what the word meant one time and then expect you to remember, which outraged me. I was like, tell me every time. So I kept having to look up words. And I really appreciated it when I felt like I got the parts of it. But really what I want to emphasize, what I'm going to tell you I got out of this book is what I got out of this book. It's not even necessarily really Buddhist stuff. It's not even like necessarily correct Buddhist stuff. But reading it really felt like kind of like the way I felt talking to Pete. There's so much good stuff I can get from this. There's so much like good advice and wisdom from a friend. But I'm not in a place even where I can like understand or use everything in this book. And I don't know that I ever will be. Sometimes I was reading this book and I was like, I'm not there. I don't know if I'm ever going to be there.
That's fair.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. But I was like, is that allowed? I don't think I'm ready for this. Help, 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 help. A central part of it is that groundlessness is a good place to be. So that moment when things fall apart, when the hole opens up from under you, that's reality. That is the most real it can be. And it gets us to really notice what's happening around us, the birds, the flowers. And it's an opportunity to see things clearly because we have to be in that moment where when it happens. You can't be like thinking about the future or in the past. And that we can see things are actually falling apart is clarity, because in truth, that's what it's like all the time, is like basic tenet of Buddhism. You can't hang your hat on anything you can hang your hat on. That relationship where you were like, this is real, this is solid, making plans for the future, at any time, anything you have like that can go. So that's the value in being in the moment, because then you have it, what's there now. That whole future you lost, but you didn't have to lose it because it wasn't there.
No, I understand that. You're making a face, but I understand that. Because when you live in... I don't remember which book we read that said this, but it's this thing of... I mean, this is very simplified, that focusing too much on the past is depression and focusing too much on the future is anxiety. It's that thing of, like, the more you think and try and plan around the future, it's because you're anxious, because it's the fear of, like, not knowing what's going to happen.
Yes. And so, like, the idea is that... to think that at any point we're going to get it all together is unrealistic. There's, like, to seek for lasting security is futile. So, like, this podcast where we're trying to make things better, and, like, basically there's a lot in this book that's, like, self-improvement doesn't exist. Everything that you need is always right there. You can't make yourself better or worse. It's all, like, right there behind a thing. In Tibetan, there's this word called ye tang chi. And the ye means totally, completely, and the rest of it means exhausted. And altogether, yang te chi means totally tired out, and or like totally fed up. And it describes an experience of complete hopelessness, of completely giving up hope. And that's an important point. This is the beginning of the beginning. Without giving up hope that there is somewhere better to be, that there is someone better to be, we will never relax with who we are and where we are.
Okay. From a nervous system trauma point of view, that makes so much sense, because I think oftentimes our nervous system is like, we're in danger right now. That's when we have anxiety. Our nervous system is like, I think something is dangerous right now. And then what we do is we go, okay, well, if I make a spreadsheet and plan my trip, then I won't feel unsafe anymore, because I can rely on the safety of knowing that I have done the right thing. But actually, that feeling of unsafety in our nervous system and our bodies stems from something else that is just a feeling in our bodies. So yeah, there's no, and this pains me to say, there is no amount of spreadsheets that will make you feel better. But I don't know if I even believe that, but I know it's true. I just don't want to believe that, because I really love my spreadsheets.
But one thing I really like about this book is, like, it's really not berating you at any point. And over again, she says, like, you have to try to get lasting security. You have to do these things. It's not wrong for you to do that, because trying to get lasting security teaches us a lot. Because if we never try to do it, we never notice that it can't be done.
I mean, it sounds like she's never seen my spreadsheets.
I know, I've seen your spreadsheets. Listen, if anybody's spreadsheets can do it, it's yours. But this is a hard one for me. Hopelessness. I'm a hopeful person. This is like when I've read things about meditation and tried meditation before. Actually, this is from another Pema Chodron book that I've started many times called Start Where You Are, which is the only place I could start from, you know. The meditation instruction is to, like, imagine your consciousness like the sun, and that everything that drifts in front of it, so fear, anxiety, a story about something, is just a cloud floating in front of the sun. Like, it's there, and then it's going to go away. And the sun, your brightness, is going to stay there. But the instruction is also to do the same thing with hope. If hope drifts in front of you, you have to let that go too. It's just a feeling, and it's not going to stay. And that is the thing that I have gotten hung up on meditation all the time. When I'm like letting anxiety and fear float by my son, I'm like, okay, fine, bye, bye, bye. When hope is there, I want to like give it to the keys to my apartment. I want to clear out drawers for it. I love feeling hopeful.
I'm the exact opposite.
Oh, wow. That's exact so opposite. Funny.
Hopeful, absolutely. Like, this feels so relevant to my life right now. I have two very good things coming up this week. And I was thinking about this yesterday. Part of me was like, oh, I'm so excited. And then immediately the voice in my head went, no. Because what if it doesn't happen? It might get cancelled. It might not work out. It might not be fun. At one point, I was like, you might trip on the way there and then you will fall and bleed and it'll be horrible.
Wow.
And then I thought, oh, wow. I don't think I've ever like looked forward to something because the voice in my head is always like, you might be disappointed. Wow. So when I'm doing the cloud thing, when I'm trying to be in the moment, I'll happily let hope pass, like absolutely. But letting fear pass, the fear that is protecting me from being disappointed.
Hank.
Hank is on board with me. That's what I feel the fear does. I feel like the fear is protecting me. Because, oh yeah, what if I was looking forward to something and then on the way there I trip? I will be so sad and so disappointed. But if I'm prepared for that, I can trip and be like, see, that's what I thought would happen. Now I'm no longer sad. And we know that's also not what happens, but you're going to be sad either way. You can't prepare yourself to not be sad. You can't live your life trying to not ever be sad. But I'm trying.
I like how
the spreadsheets.
You said you're going to be sad either way. And I was like, no, sometimes you're not going to be sad.
We're really two sides of the same coin.
Sophie, sometimes you're not going to be sad.
Yeah, but then it's fine, right? If I'm expecting the worst and it ends up fine, I'll be twice as happy because like, oh, wow, I thought this was going to be horrible.
I don't know.
And now it turns out it's great.
A really nice thing, when I've had 3 miscarriages, and whenever I was pregnant or like thinking about that, there was this feeling that's like, okay, if you let yourself be hopeful about this or excited about this, that's really stupid. That's really dumb because you really know what can happen. I never got anything out of that mindset. Like, it did not protect me. I have a friend also who like recently had a miscarriage and now is pregnant again. I got this advice from my other grown-up friend, not Pete, but Catherine. And she was like, what if you just like let yourself want the thing all the way that you want it, knowing that maybe it's not going to happen, but that it doesn't protect you to try to not want it. It doesn't protect you to like just focus on how bad things can happen. And that really helped me. I mean, it helped me be in each moment of what was happening and feel what I was feeling and just like live a fuller life.
It's so hard for me to accept it doesn't protect you because I know it's true, but I'm so scared of the disappointment. So scared of it. But it's true. And I think it's kind of blowing my mind because I think in my head I'm like, oh, the solution to this is to allow myself to feel hopeful about things. But what the book is saying is, no, neither. You just stay in the moment. You do not know what's going to happen. So neither of those two, anxiety or hope, is like accurate.
The book is saying, and I'm not sure how much I believe, I think the world could use some more hope before we get down to this part. Like, this is maybe the eventual truth, but I feel like if we right the ship towards hope a little bit, I think it's going to go better. But yes, the book is saying that not that you shouldn't feel hope, but that when it does, you have to acknowledge it the same way you would acknowledge fear as something that can't be counted on, as the only thing that can be counted on is this moment. It's not a bad thing to feel hope. It's not wrong to feel hope. It's not wrong to feel fear. But to get wrapped up in it and let it carry you away is not going to help you.
Yeah. So it's more like, I'm so excited for this thing that might happen if I don't trip. But I could also trip. But it could also happen. And if it happens, I'm excited for it.
Or it's like not thinking about that and being like, oh, I just noticed I was excited about that thing. Oh, I just felt a fear that I would trip or something. Huh. That was a thought that I had. Here I am. Help hole. So the thing about...
This is so difficult.
But does it make sense? I know
it does make sense. It's
difficult.
Just annoying.
Yeah, okay.
It's emotionally difficult and annoying. But yeah, logically, this is probably absolutely correct.
Okay. So the book says that the reason we feel suffering, that we're in a cycle of suffering and pain, is because of the 8 worldly dharmas. Dharma is one of these words I had to keep looking up. Basically, I think it means the nature of reality, and it's like the universal truth taught by Buddha. The 8 worldly dharmas are the things that exist that like bring us suffering and feeling, basically. They're each 2 sides of the same coin. So it's like one side is things we like and the other is like the opposite thing that we don't like and we try to avoid. And what brings us suffering is trying to get to the one side and get away from the other. And the 8 dharmas are pleasure and pain. We like pleasure. We try to go through pleasure. We try to do it to avoid pain. We try to escape pain.
Uh-huh.
Loss and gain. So we like getting what we want and getting more things, and we don't like feeling like we lost something we had and was ours. Fame and disgrace. So we like positive attention. We really like it when people are looking at us and we're doing well, and we hate it when people are looking at us and we're not doing well. And then the last ones are praise and blame.
Ooh.
So we love it when people are telling us how great we're doing. And we hate it when somebody's telling us we're not doing great and it's our fault. And the idea is that if we can escape that cycle of going back and forth, going from one to the other, seeking the one, escaping the other, that there is like a middle place to be that is right now and that is present and that is peace. And in her constant retelling of it, that the natural state of people is a state of joy. So like you think of these things repressing your emotions or something, but that what she's saying is that the natural state is one of joy and peace. And so that like that's what's in the middle of those things. And it's not that you have to like never feel them and that you're supposed to berate yourself if you do. It's that when you feel them, you just notice them and let them go instead of getting all wound up in them, making that your story or your life or your path. You stay on the path of like going forward and just noticing those things when they come up.
Oh my God. I'm having like a mind blown moment. I'm almost like envisioning it like moving from one to the other. Also because they feel like the only 2 options. So if I am not being praised, I assume that I am then being blamed and criticized. And when I'm being blamed and criticized, I feel like the way out of that is to be praised. And I hadn't thought of there as being a something in between those 2 things, where it's neither.
Really good part about this part is that, so she says, whenever we're feeling good, our thoughts are usually about the things we like, praise, gain, pleasure, and fame. When we're feeling uncomfortable and irritable and fed up, our thoughts and emotions are probably revolving around something like pain, loss, disgrace, or blame. And so she says, like, if you are wrapped up in these things, your moods are dictated entirely by what happens to you and the way that you perceive them on those 4 spectrums. My friend Oleg Beck has this joke that really, like, it reminded me of this, and I loved it when I heard it for the first time and the second time and the third time. And the joke is that he loves social media. It's, like, so helpful for him to wake up in the morning and then check on his post, count your likes and your followers, and then so it can tell you if you're in a good mood or not. I love that. I'm like, oh, yeah. It just really got me to see, like, oh, yeah, why does that get to decide?
Yeah. Not to be dramatic. For me, this is the entire podcast. Like, this is the whole point of the podcast. Like, this is kind of shifting something inside of me in a very provocative way. Like, I want to be like, shut up. I want to go back to not having thought of this. Ah, I like this thing of you have to give up. I feel like so much of self-help stuff is like, how to get those things, how to get the praise and how to, you know, high self-esteem, like you are loved, people love you, you want, you know, all those things. And there's something about thinking of that as also something you can get caught up in as the opposite of existing in the present.
Yeah.
If I saw myself as this water bottle I'm holding up now, and then I saw praise and blame and criticism and loss and gain as something that is happening to the water bottle, but it doesn't change the water bottle, right? It's just like, oh, this is being thrown at it, and now this is being thrown at it. Like, if I saw someone saying, you're the most beautiful water bottle in the world, and then I saw someone else saying, you're a disgusting, gross water bottle, I would still think of the water bottle as the same as it was before. It's just a water bottle. So why can't I think of myself as the water bottle?
Sophie, you're the water bottle.
I'm the water bottle. Help.
But the thing that she says again and again and again, which I love, 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 because I was like, oh, Buddhism is just a lot of things that I could do wrong, I think is what I, is that how I hear it. And she just says again and again, you got to stop struggling against our thoughts and relax. Oh, and realize that honesty and humor are far more inspiring and helpful than any kind of solemn religious striving for or against anything. Opening and relaxing with those feelings, with the fame, the pain, the all of those wants and stuff and thoughts, and not suppressing them is how you actually get in touch with that basic groundlessness. So not suppressing them and not trying to like hook on to them and like go along for the cloud ride, but letting them occur and just noticing them are the way to do it. It's not wrong if you're sitting there trying to meditate or whatever and you have those feelings. That's the point of it, is to sit there in a safe place and practice just noticing it.
Yeah, so it's not about judging. It's not like, oh no, now I'm striving for disgrace again. Now I'm striving for gain. Now, like, it's just about going, oh, when you look at that, I am currently experiencing wanting praise.
Yes, yes. And there's a technique that's called refraining. That's the part that sounds like Buddhism is boring. Buddhism is keeping yourself holy. Buddhism is like stopping yourself from doing the fun, she says, juicy things. But it's not. It's about noticing when you're acting out impulsively and just like trying to go without entertaining it away for a moment. And if you can't, noticing that you couldn't. Addiction.
What do you mean entertaining it away?
So like grabbing for something when you're uncomfortable, grabbing for your phone, grabbing for a drink, grabbing for all of the things that we, grabbing for a spreadsheet, grabbing for whatever makes you feel like the uncomfortable feeling isn't there, or like you look at something else. Just trying to feel it a little bit longer is what you're going for. And if you can't feel it for a second longer, then the whole instruction is just to notice that you couldn't feel it for a second longer. That is then the step.
Wow.
It's the same. When you're trying to refrain, when you're trying not to grab for something else, that's not confusion. If you're trying to refrain and you can't do it, that's actually really good in the beginning of clarity. That's like even just noticing that like you can't not reach for your phone when you're uncomfortable is the absolute right step, and not to beat yourself up for them. This was written in 1995, so she doesn't have anything about reaching for your phone, but I can do it. I can translate it.
We know what she means. We know what she would say today.
Okay. This is one of my favorite things, is about Maitri and loving kindness. So a tenet,
Maitri?
Maitri is unconditional friendliness and loving kindness. And that feels like, I mean, it feels like what I got from Pete, or like my feeling about that. But it's in this, she's talking about it mostly how we need to give it to ourselves. And this, I thought so much about the self-compassion episode that we did and how you were explaining this stuff to me. And I was really trying to listen. Other people deserve niceness. I don't. Like, why would I be nice to myself? I need to do better. And this part helped me so much with that. Because what it's saying basically is you have to be kind to yourself and patient with yourself, because then you are bringing more kindness and patience into the world. And that blew my mind. I was like, of course, if I'm being mean to myself, there's mean out there, and it changes the way I interact with myself and with other people. And the idea that being kind to myself is how I need to practice being kind to other people. I think there's something about that in the self-compassion book, but I just couldn't hear it the same way. And in this one, I was like,
yeah, I feel that too. Since the self-compassion episode, I've started almost noticing people's meanness or niceness as like energies. I know that sounds really like, whoa. But when people are saying something that is cruel or something that is like mocking or negative, I've almost felt it as like, ooh, there's some negative things happening in the room right now. And that's quite interesting. Yeah, if I'm nice to myself, then that should also come across as a positive energy.
Yeah. It says, the most fundamental aggression to ourselves is to remain ignorant by not having the courage and respect to look at ourselves honestly and gently.
Oof.
Oh, right. Because if you're not being kind to yourself, you actually can't look at yourself either. I will go away and hide from any truth about myself that I'm going to beat myself up about. And I was like, this actually, self-compassion, looking at myself kindly and with gentleness, is what is going to enable me to see the hard things that I need to change and the things I need to do.
I like this because it's not saying you are perfect no matter what you do. It's saying, yeah, of course you have some, I don't know, it doesn't use the words flaws, does it? But like, you're seeing yourself as what you are. And yeah. That's, well, I guess neither good or bad, but just is.
She explicitly says, like, this isn't about self-improvement. This is not about, like, trying to, like, convince yourself you're the greatest or don't worry, sweetheart, everything's going to be fine. It's a process instead of, like, getting closer to yourself by being kind and honest, taking away any mask of, like, the way you have to act like there's nothing wrong with you. Because you don't, if you're going to be kind about what you see there.
Wow.
Can you read this next part, Sophie, the part in green?
Oh.
The painful thing?
I can try. The painful thing is that when we buy into disapproval, we are practicing disapproval. When we buy into harshness, we are practicing harshness. The more we do it, the stronger those qualities become. How sad is it that we become so expert at causing harm to ourselves and others? Whew. The trick then is to practice gentleness and letting go. We can learn to meet whatever arises with curiosity and not make it such a big deal. Instead of struggling against the force of confusion, we could meet it and relax. When we do that, we gradually discover that clarity is always there. In the middle of the worst scenario of the worst person in the world, in the midst of all the heavy dialogue with ourselves, open space is always there. Okay.
Okay, Pema.
I think what I'm hearing is Pema is praising me for being so good at harshness and disapproval.
Yeah, she's really
impressed.
I've
been practicing for a long time.
She's really impressed.
Someone said this to me recently. They were like, they said something like, I don't mind if you criticize me. You can say whatever you want. And I thought, I don't think you know how good I am at saying something hurtful. Like, I think I have it in me to really, truly ruin you.
Do you know what's
just
really nice?
I think I'm so good at it. I'm so good at circumventing. I've been in like 20 years in therapy and have therapists like teaching me how to be self-loving. And my brain has managed to find ways of circumventing that every single time. Like, I'm very good at criticizing.
But you know what I think that's also made you good at? Because I think you know that about yourself and you are gentle with other people. Like, I can feel, and I am so grateful for, actually, when I can feel that you are going to give me criticism or feedback on something. I feel the pillows that you place around it, the kindness and the understanding that, like, and also I see it when you do it to other people. And I just, honestly, I don't want it to stop. Like, it is not something I want.
Oh, no.
But I'm just like, yeah, please actually be that gentle with me every time you want to tell me exactly what you think, because then I can take it. And maybe, like, you know, at some points when we're in a when we're already in a conversation or something, you can just say it without all the pillows and stuff. But because you're so good at thinking those thoughts, you also really know, understand the other side of it, I think. And you're really gentle and cautious.
I think I criticize the way a giant made of rocks would carry a tiny baby bird. Like, I'm so careful because I know that if I just like wiggle my finger, I'm crushing the baby bird.
That's, I can, I tell criticize from like the first breath you take in a voice note whether or not you're gonna tell me something that you consider is criticism, which, by the way, it's not always what I consider as criticism. Like, sometimes you'll be really gentle telling me something that I don't care about at all. I just appreciate it so much. Keep doing that. Like,
oh, yeah. I mean, I have sometimes not done it, and it has always been catastrophic. If I've said something that I didn't realize was a criticism, and I won't have placed the pillows around it, and then I get the reply back, I'm like, Oh, fuck. Someone sent me something that was actually written by... I thought they were sending me something that someone else had written, but it was something they had written.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
so
yeah.
I was just honest and upfront. And then they were like, oh, well, this hurts. And I was like, oh, fuck. In my head, I'm like, well, I just ruined someone's life and they'll never recover and I'm evil.
We are always carrying around an image of ourselves, an image we hold in our minds. And one way to describe that is small mind. So like our ideas of who we are and what we're like and how we need to be. And that is called in Tibetan sem. And in Tibetan, there are several words for mind, but two are particularly helpful to know are sem and ripka. And sem is what we experience as like discursive thoughts, like our monologue when we're walking down the street, always reinforcing an image of ourselves and the way that we see other people, like commenting in our head on like what they look like, what they're doing wrong, what they're doing right. And ripka literally means intelligence or brightness. So it's like the sun that the clouds are floating in front of. And that's always there in us behind all the planning and worrying, behind the wishing and wanting that we're doing, and the constant talking to ourselves that we're doing. And there's always ripka right there that we can always access if we can just quiet this chatter.
The water bottle.
The water bottle. The brilliance of the water bottle is always there. She gives this example of in Nepal, dogs at night are barking a lot. There's a lot of dogs barking at night. And then every once in a while, every like 20 minutes, just all the dogs stop barking. And for like a few seconds or minutes, you can just hear quiet. And she's like, that's what ripka is like. It's like when you don't even notice that the dogs are barking and then they stop for a second. The rug gets pulled out under you is like often the way into it. But the more you practice noticing the silence when the dogs stop barking, the more that extends into the rest of your life. The more that you notice when there is nothing else there, the more often it will happen. And so she says, like, the goal isn't to completely escape.
Get the dogs to stop barking. Yeah.
The goal isn't to try to get rid of the dogs, but it's just... Yeah. To notice the spaces in between, and then eventually maybe you can get like the dogs in your mind down to just like a yip and a yap and a little bit of this, but that you can practice that by just noticing when there's no dogs barking.
Some musical experiences have given me that feeling.
Oh.
I very rarely go to concerts, but if I'm at a concert, there are moments where I feel like, oh my, like I'm so in this moment, I'm really feeling the music. I am not thinking about the past or the future. I'm just listening to the music. That feels a bit like that.
An interesting thing to think about in terms of like stand-up, that is just honing the dogs, I feel like. And it's just interesting to be like, oh yeah, the constant chatter in my mind, I pay extra attention to it sometimes because I'm like, could that be a joke? Could that be a joke? Could that be a joke? And I like turn it up. I don't have the answer to this, but it's like a question for me. I also think, can I use that skill as a way to point out something that furthers things? Like, do I use it that way? Or is it just like contributing to the chatter? I just think it's like an interesting thing to think about. I think a lot of stand-up, certainly stand-up that I've done, is just like, this is what I thought, and this is what I thought, and this is what I thought, and this is what I thought. And what is the purpose of that? I don't even mean it like it's pointless. It might have a purpose as in pointing out like that we're doing that all the time and the silliness of thoughts, but
that's... I think we should put down as a book we want to do in the future, Sen and the Art of Stand-Up.
Oh, good.
I would love to hear from our listeners if you'd be interested in an episode where we talk about stand-up, which of course we're quite well-versed in ourselves. I don't know if that's something that's as interesting to everyone else, but I think it would be really interesting. So I would love to hear from our listeners if that would be something you'd be interested in.
This book also talks a lot about the kind of thing that's in the war of art, which is facing your fear. The fear is actually, it's not a bad thing. Everything naturally feels fear, and to try to escape it is like, it's pointless. You're going to feel afraid, and that fear is pointing you often to the truth. She tells this story about when she was 10, her best friend had these nightmares where monsters were chasing her. And she asked her friend, like, oh my gosh, that's so scary. What do the monsters look like? And her friend didn't know because she was always running away from them. So the next night in her dream, her friend stops running away from the monster. And with like all of the bravery she can muster in her dream, she turns around and looks at them. And she sees the monsters and she looks at them all exactly how they look. And while she's watching, they sort of like stop being such scary monsters. And she notices like one kind of like looks like a teddy bear. And one is like the color of her blanket. And then they all kind of just become cartoon versions of themselves. And then they dissolve. I don't know. I don't ever think of myself as like a dream person. But whenever these books have dreams in them, I'm just like, yep, yep, yep.
Well, my cousin had a nightmare where something like a hand came out of the wall. It kept coming out of the wall and then she would run away from it. And her therapist at the time said, have you tried taking the hand? So she did. And out came her grandmother.
Oh my God.
And started telling her something. And it was no longer scary. It was just like, oh, hi, I'm here to say this thing. And I think it's so incredibly true. There's fear. I don't want to say legit fear. There's the fear of, what if suddenly a tiger broke through my front door and started eating me? And that's a constant fear I have. What if that happens? And then there's fear, oh shit, there's a tiger in my living room. And that's like a usable fear. Fear is like adrenaline, right? It makes you like run away and like gives you the energy to do something about it. But once you have a fear for something that isn't real yet or might never be, it's just kind of useless.
Yeah.
It feels like the same thing. It's like being afraid of the dark. It's like you're afraid of the dark because you don't know what's there.
But also there's something in this where it's like in this and the war of art, which is really like a contradiction to my natural state that I am leaning into lately. It's not just useless, actually. It's a thing you should move towards. That fear, when you feel it, towards something that isn't actually a tiger in the living room. Although in this book, they do have like examples of a monk running at a dog that's chasing him while everyone else is running away, and then the dog gets confused and goes the other way, like real danger fear, but he's like deep in meditation and he's like, well, that's the only answer, is to run at it. But that things that are like what you feel afraid of in your work or in your creative pursuits or in your like life, that those are actually, that's a sign to go towards it, to like grab the hand coming out of the wall. That if you learn to pay attention to those things and question why you feel the fear, that often it is pointing you at the thing you need
to do. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think the tiger example is wild, but like when I was talking about, oh, I can't get excited about something because what if I trip on the way there and I start bleeding? That is a fear, and then I shut down, where actually walking towards that would be to say, then what? You've tripped, you've fallen, then what do you feel? Well, I would feel sad and stupid. Aha! So you feel sad and stupid. Maybe we should figure something out about that.
Mm-hmm. And you feel sad and stupid because you're excited about the thing. Like it points you, yeah. Like, why do you
because
feel...
Because I was vulnerable.
Yeah.
Because then I would be vulnerable and fragile. And then I would be a human being. And that's scary because if you're a human being, you're weak.
And then you're not a human being then... though, Sophie. You're a water bottle.
I'm just a water bottle with some spreadsheets. I hope that makes sense. Otherwise, feel free to message us and I will try and make sense of it.
When I think of meditation, I think it's boring. I think it's like that the point of it is to just spend longer times in meditation and that you just are trying to train yourself. It doesn't appeal to me to meditate. And a thing that I like about this book is that it says that the point of meditation is to practice those things, to practice facing your fear, to practice letting your thoughts come and go and not getting attached to them, to practice feeling that open brightness inside of you instead of the chatter in the safest place possible, just on a pillow on the floor where nothing can hurt you. And that the reason to do it is so that you can have those moments more and be better at it while you're living your real life. I did not ever think about that like that before. I truly don't think I knew what meditation was for. I thought it was so that you got better at meditating. But thinking about it as practice for having that peace in your life, I was like, okay, all right. I could see the appeal.
That's how I've always seen meditation. Like, you're practicing being in the moment. The few times where I've tried doing it, like, I remember once I got into quite a good habit of meditating, I think like 10 minutes in the morning and in the evening. And I remember being, for some reason, at Oxford Circus in London during rush hour. I think during this, like, December, when it's just a sea of people. It's like being at a concert. People are just bumping into each other. And I remember feeling like severe anxiety. Like, I was about to have an anxiety attack. And then because I was meditating, I managed to be like, oh, let me do the thing. And I was like, and it was something like count 1, 2, 3, 4, and then whatever it was. And I was doing that. And then the anxiety just went away. And I was like completely calm in the sea of people. And I was like, oh, that's what that is. Oh, that's why we do it. This makes sense now.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I don't think I've ever really put together, like, I'm like, oh, it's so that you're better at it while you're meditating. And for some reason, reading that it's like for regular life, I was like, There's a good description of how to meditate in this like sect of Buddhism. And it's just really nice instructions. And the main one is, when you have a thought, it's not to be mean to yourself about it, but it's to say, notice with lightness and gentleness, thinking. When you have a thought, just to say to it, thinking, and then let it go. And there was a Texan guy that came to one of Pema's workshops, and he was really like touched by how she really encouraged people to just be like really nice and fun and kind to themselves when they said that and not hurt themselves. And so the Texas guy was like, so I always say, thinking good, buddy, when he's meditating and he has a thought. And she put that in the book. She's like, sometimes I say that now too. Just like, thinking good, buddy.
I like speaking to it, being like, oh, that's a nice thought you had there.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's the thing you said. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm listening. I think it's important to let the sort of chatter know that it's being heard, or else it might get louder. So it goes like, acknowledge it, but not give it the power. So it's like, what if you trip? You're like, okay, that's a nice thought. Okay. I heard that. And now I'm going to go back to being not that person.
Thank you for listening to Help Hole.
Please go and check out our Patreon if you want double the episodes and triple the fun. And that's patreon.com/helphole.
Patreons get double the really fun, thoughtful episodes, newsletters, discounts, and tickets to live shows. And we will answer your questions in our advice episodes.
Please subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcast. But most importantly, please tell people about it if you liked it. We're currently a bit bad at social media, so we're really relying on you to spread the word.
Yeah, please, please, please take a minute. It takes 1 second to rate us on Spotify and Apple. Right now, we have 87 reviews on Spotify. Listen, we check a lot. I check a lot. And on Apple Podcasts, you can write a review and we read them all. And soon we want to make a post.
We read them a lot.
We read them a lot. Soon we're going to make a post where we highlight good reviews of our podcast. So write one there, because we would like to highlight it.
On the next episode, I'm going to talk about the book The Joy of Being Selfish by Michelle Ellman. So look forward to that. Thank you to our wonderful producer Amanda and to Nikki Elson for the jingle. Bye.
Bye. Help Hole.